The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So I wanted to welcome everybody here. My name's Helen Gim. I am proud to be your city councilwoman here in the great city of Philadelphia. I'm very proud to also be a part of a city that is unabashedly the proudest, gayest city in America right now. We're a proud sanctuary city for all. We're standing up for LGBTQ rights here in our city, and especially for our trans community. And I am really excited and honored to have an incredible panel today. I hope everybody picked up The Stonewall Reader by Jason Bauman, which is outside, a beautiful cover, and a wonderful anthology that tells the story of civil rights, a community, and a fight for justice from so many different angles. And similarly, tonight you're in for a huge treat because we also have an incredible panel that tells a story from the viewpoint of institutions in history, from the arts, from radical activists, and from historians. And so that's what Stonewall is. I'm so honored also just to do a shout out to our free library, which offers these programs here in our city for free to everybody. Let's remember to keep supporting our public library and make sure that they stay open in every single branch, in every single neighborhood all across the city of Philadelphia. So tonight, we are featuring a rock star panel. Of course, our big star is Jason Bauman, who is the New York Public Library Coordinator of Humanities and LGBTQ Collections and is the curator for Stonewall at 50, which is an incredible exhibit of original photography, stories, and a beautiful place at the New York Public Library. So if you're ever up in New York, make sure you go up there and see it. It's through July. We also have our own legend here in Philadelphia, Mark Siegel, founder of the Philadelphia Gay News, activist extraordinaire and a fighter each and every day. Carla Jay, who is an author and distinguished professor emeritus at Pace University. And Joel Hall, Third World Gay Revolution director who came all the way from Chicago in the pouring rain and is going to talk about the celebration of our arts community and how much it contributes to our growing sense of humanity. But this is about taking it over to the next step. I'm excited to welcome all of you here today. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for making space for history and love and passion and protest and politics in this moment, and enjoy the evening. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Bauman, there's Mark Siegel, Joel Hall, and at the end, Carla Jay. I'm just going to start by talking about the Stonewall Reader for a moment. Could I borrow your copy? Because I realize I forgot to bring my copy. So the Reader that came out a few months ago and goes with the exhibition at the show, the exhibition at New York Public Library. And so in the book, I really try to collect autobiographical narratives from people who were at Stonewall riots, also autobiographical narratives of people before. What did it feel like to be LGBTQ in the United States before Stonewall? Also the real pioneering activism that took place before Stonewall. Then a series of narratives of people who were at Stonewall and what it felt like to them, what their memories were. And lastly, a section after Stonewall that's people's memories of the activism that really exploded after the Stonewall riots and through the 1970s. And so each of you contributed to this, to the anthology. So what I wanted to question to start with, and so I have this before Stonewall sort of section in the book. You're all in the either during or after, but as I've been working on Stonewall for the past 3 years, it always seems like you don't really understand what happened, that it was a turning point, and you have to sort of know what it was like before in order to see that. And so I'm interested from each of you, what was it like for you before Stonewall, and how does that era seem to you before?
I was 18 when I left Philadelphia to move to New York. I left Philadelphia, this city that we all love dearly, because at 18 in 1969, I thought I was the only gay person in Philadelphia. There were no other gay people in Philadelphia. So I went to New York. And the reason I felt that way was that we were totally invisible. You didn't see us on TV. You didn't see us in magazines. You didn't hear us on the radio. We weren't on movies. We were nowhere. And if you wanted to find out who you were as a gay person, about the only place you might be able to go was the library. And they might, if you were lucky, have 5 books, and you would find out in those 5 books that you were something called a homosexual, and that it might be it was a scientific term that maybe belonged in a scientific lab where they can experiment on you because you're not, you know, mentally correct. And, you know, you're definitely not morally correct, and you therefore can't be employed. So you have no life. You will end up sad. And that didn't sound like me. So I moved to New York. That's what it was like for me.
Okay, well, I grew up in Chicago in the ghetto. In the ghetto. And I was always gay. I was never straight identified. And it was very, very difficult because you were constantly under a microscope by everyone if you were openly gay, including the police, first of all, your neighbors or the people that are around you, the people that you went to school with, even relatives. So you had to build your own defense to stand up for yourself, because I knew who I was as a young, very young person, and I stood up for myself, and it got me into a lot of trouble. I ended up being incarcerated for 4 years as a teenager because I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Not that I was committing any crime other than being homosexual, but the judge saw fit to send me to a mental institution for correction of my problem, which was my life. So that didn't work out so well for them. Because I never went. Okay. But I did end up in the Illinois Youth Commission and in the penal system of Chicago, or of Illinois, of the state of Illinois. And I went through that until I was 17, and then when I got out, I just flew out into the street. And I had something called an independent parole at 17, and my life continued from there. I was very, very active and involved in the movement in Chicago and in New York, but initially in Chicago, with gay liberation and with Third World Gay Revolution. And there was also a group of black gay men that called themselves the Black Philotetes. And they were an intellectual group of men that got together every Sunday to discuss how we were going to live and how we were going to get through this. So it was a very interesting childhood, and it led me into activism. The activism was taking care of myself and my brothers and sisters. And so here I am today. I'm still doing it now. I'm 70, so I'm an old O Chow. Okay? But, you know, I still work with a lot of young people, particularly young gay men and women, who are coming out or who have been out and that are homeless. Their parents have either kicked them out or they've left out of being tortured, and they end up somehow coming to me. So I'm a father, I'm a papa. They call me papa, they call me father, and now they even call me, what was the other one, Craig?
Uncle.
I'm uncle, that's my husband, Craig. Say hi. Okay, so that's my initial involvement in the movement. And then I moved to New York. That's a whole other story.
We'll get to that. And Carla?
I was, prior to Stonewall, I was involved in mostly in the radical feminist movement. I was involved in Red Stockings, which was the group that developed consciousness raising in the United States, and the slogan, the personal is political. The problem with Red Stockings, or there were many problems and problematic people as well, but the one of the problems was that they had a class analysis of feminism. They were a Marxist group, and they saw women as social class. And lesbians didn't fit into this class analysis. We just didn't fit there. I always said that being in Red Stockings was very akin to later experiences I had in Weight Watchers. It seems rude, but when I went to Weight Watchers, and I did go there, we sat around and talked about food. And in Red Stockings, the women wanted to talk about men. I mean, it was like, you know, men, that's all they wanted to talk about. I'll find a different one, I'll find a more low-calorie man. You know, it was really, and that's what it was like. So they just either didn't want to hear about lesbians, and I had to compartmentalize my life. I had to pretend that I wasn't a lesbian with them, because they really would have, They would not have taken my thoughts seriously. I wouldn't have been able to be a member of the group. And, you know, even recently I was talking to someone who's writing a book about that period of time, and we were talking about a woman who passed away years ago named Irene Pislikis. And I talked about the fact that Irene went to the first lesbian dance and that she was a lesbian. And she said, oh, no, she wasn't. I said, oh, yes, she was. I said, but she never, even, you know, 10 years after Stonewall, was afraid to tell the other women in Red Stockings that she was a lesbian. That was the power of it. So, you know, when Stonewall happened, it was really very transformative for many of us who had these different parts of our lives to feel whole as LGBT people.
And Kali, I think you're transitioning to my next question, because this year with Stonewall and the 50th anniversary, in one way, Stonewall wasn't the first of these riots that take place, right? And there are a number of them in the 1960s. And then there was already this movement, although small, from the 1950s on. But yet it seems the society really did change in that year, and things changed for LGBT people in 69, 70. And so I'm wondering, what did that moment of Stonewall mean to you then? And also, do you see it differently now, 50 years later? Like, what did it mean to you then, and how do you see it now, 50 years later?
So these last few weeks, Carl and I have been doing a lot of press interviews together and apart. We're very big in Sweden, by the way. The Swedes love us. And you could literally hear us on Swedish radio and television. I have no, and they follow us around. It's really strange. But being 18 and in New York at that time, and as I said earlier, I left Philadelphia because I thought I was the only person. You got to down to the village to try to find where other gay people were. And as my good sister, Jerry Hughes, used to say, and Carly, you remember this, when any of us found a Christmas tree for the first time, we found Nirvana. It was our people. About 2 weeks before Stonewall, I walked into the Mattachine, and I was asked to leave. I was 18 years, Mattachine is one of the organizations that he was talking about. And in New York, it was the gay organization. I was asked to leave because I was 18 years old, and the reason for that was they would not have anyone in the building that was not 21 or above because they were afraid of being raided for disrupting the morals of a minor. So I was turned. I felt I was being turned away by my own community. I didn't realize that until just a few weeks ago. And what I realized now is that when that night of Stonewall, when I left Mattachine, I met a man by the name of Marty Robinson. Marty was creating a group called the Action Group, which is often called the Action Group of Mattachine. It was not. We had no connection to Mattachine at all. It's one of those things that historians have done that really gets me pissed off. So there were only four of us at that time. There are two of us still alive today. But on the night of Stonewall, Marty came up to me and several other people and gave us a piece of chalk. And he said, please write on the walls in the street, tomorrow night, Stonewall. And so when I think about that evening today, I think about the fact that we weren't just rebelling against the police who were in the building. I think a little part of us was also rebelling against our own community, because they wouldn't have trans people. They wouldn't have young people. Hello. And they wouldn't have people of color. Take a look at the pictures of those early demonstrations. And I have. There's one black woman in all of those photos. All we were represented by at that point from those early organizations were white men in suits and ties and white women in dresses. And it didn't work. It was a failure. And I think we're afraid to say that. And here's the numbers to prove that beyond a shadow of a doubt. Those marches, the biggest thing they ever did were the national marches here in Philadelphia every July 4th, 65 to 69. No more than 100 people ever attended any one of them. That is the premier one day a year when gay people were meeting. Well, not one of the organizations, of all those organizations that put those things together, have 100 members. Not one. In fact, you could actually make a case for the fact that there were not more than 100 out people in all of America in 1969. Think about that, 100. Gay liberation is created from the ashes of Stonewall. Within 1 year, and that was the most magical year, we created the first trans organization. I think you might have heard of Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. Well, STAR was a part of GLF. Gay Youth, the nation's first gay youth organization, was part of GLF. Hey, back there, some gay youthers. You're not gay youth anymore. And neither am I. We created the first legal alerts, medical alerts. We were on the streets the third and fourth nights of the so-called riots, handing out flyers. It was illegal for homosexuals to congregate. And we were handing out flyers against the police. We demonstrated against the police. We demonstrated at Time Life. We demonstrated at Village Voice. That was the magic of that whole first year. We created the first community center. If all that were not enough, Ellen and Craig Rodwell created Christopher Street Liberation Day Committee, which created the first gay pride. That first gay pride, 1 year later, 15,000 people marched. A movement from 100 to 15,000. Now, where does that number 15,000 come from? That comes from many of us who were there. But I can give you the other two numbers that are used. Let's see, there's the number that's used by the article in the New York Times. That was 5,000 people. Okay, it's not bad. The worst number comes from the memo that was sent to, you ready for this? J. Edgar Hoover, 3,000. So you could say we're anywhere between 3,000 and 15,000 from 100. That, my friends, is a magical year.
Well, at the beginning of gay liberation, I was in Chicago, actually. I later moved to New York. And one of the people that was in Chicago was Ortiz Alderson, who was a very radical black man who was gay. And he was one of the, I think they're called the Milwaukee Seven or something, that broke into the draft files and destroyed all the draft files in in Milwaukee and or Madison, wherever they keep them. And we had to smuggle him out of Chicago because the police and everybody was after him. We had to smuggle him from Chicago to New York. And I remember we drove from New York with him in the back seat of this car on the floor to make it to New York. So we got to New York. He had no place to stay. And my ex-partner when I lived in New York, Richard, was, his sister was at Columbia University and took Ortez into her room, and he stayed there for like a year, hiding from the police. Finally, he gave himself up, and he did time, and then, of course, he got out. He got sick, and he passed away. But Ortez and I were like this. We were sisters, we were brothers. Ortez was Tina Turner, and I was the iCats. We would go into the living room and we would do like a little routine of a Tina Turner and throw our hair, little wigs around and stuff. It was so cute. It was really fabulous. And Stonewall then, to me, was a turning point because I realized that there were a whole lot of other people that were like me, that were speaking up. Like I said, I've always spoke up for myself, but to see other people speaking up for themselves too, that was major for me. And it really moved me very, very much. When GLF began to factionalize and became GAA is when things started to deteriorate. Now, the last time I was in Philadelphia, I was here in 1972 at the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention that was put on by the Black Panther Party. And Women's Liberation was here, SDS, Third World Gay Revolution, GLF, GLA, GAA did not exist at that time. No, well, too radical. And so that was a very moving experience also, because what it did was it pulled all of these elements that were revolutionaries together to create a new constitution that we were going to live by. Which was a very, very good idea at that time, because it was considering everyone. And at first, the Black Panther Party was kind of like reluctant to deal with gay people because we were fringe. But during the convention, they understood that we were as radical, if not more, about being who we were than the Black Panther Party was. So they accepted us as their brothers and sisters. And eventually, Huey P. Newton even came out with this statement that he thinks that gay people were the most revolutionary people he's met. And that's a big statement. That was back in 1972. 70. Was that 70?
Yeah.
Okay. At any rate, after moving to New York, I got very involved with the movement in New York, and going to the Firehouse, and joined a collective down on 7th Street and Avenue C, a gay men's collective, and we went around the country organizing in different cities around the country and ending up back in New York. All of those men are gone now, except for one, I believe, who lives in Hawaii. And I think the difference between then and now is not much in terms of how we're being disrespected. And I think that certainly the movement meant a lot, but one of the things that the movement did not deal with was racism. in the gay community, and it was rampant. It was like being in the, it was like being in the heterosexual community. It's the same thing. And they would put ads in papers and saying, well, no femmes and no blacks and no Hispanics and no this and no that. And it was like, well, how about no you? How about that? Let's think about that. And, you know, I think that that's one of the things that we still have not dealt with in our community. I work around, like I said, a lot of young people, and of all races, all kinds of people come to me, but I respect them, and they respect me, and they respect my people, because I teach them that black people are not anything that you should fear, but people who you should adore, because we're all black, my dear. That's where we came from. We all came from Mother Africa. The DNA says so. The science says so. And that's why these people are trying to change this whole concept of evolution and stuff, saying that science is bad. Well, yeah, science is bad if you're a Christian person and you believe in that stuff, that we're supposed to be sinful. Well, homosexuality is not a sin, ever. It's always been here, it will always be here forever. It's not gonna go away. No, and black people aren't either. If you killed every single one of them, there would be a black baby show up somewhere, sometime, in some country that you didn't even hear about, okay? Because they were there in the first place. Point of information. So I just feel that we've come a long way in terms of gay liberation, that we can sit in this room and talk about it, but I do not feel that we have really dealt with the issues. And I also feel, particularly of racism, I also feel that we have not dealt with this generational gap, because you know we lost a lot of our brothers and sisters during AIDS, the AIDS epidemic, okay? There's a layer that's missing. That's all of our people, artists, dancers, choreographers, that's where I'm from, so, engineers, doctors, you name it. Everybody was dropping like flies. So there's a disconnect between the person in their 20s, 30s, and the person in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. There's that layer that's missing that we did not communicate. One of the things that I think that we can do at this point to move our movement forward is to mentor young gay people and tell them the stories of what really happened and tell them their history, their gay story, not their history. Because gay people, we have our own story. So, and people need to know that. And when you get that information, it empowers you, and it makes you feel like you have something to offer. Now, please take it upon yourself to meet a young gay person and talk with them about your experience of being gay. If all these people in here are gay, I assume. If not, that's okay. But I'm just saying that we need that level of communication happening between us and them. Otherwise, we're lost. The movement can go no further. It's something that happened, but not something that we're living. We have to live and be gay liberation all the time.
He is not done.
I'm not done.
No.
Don't get me started.
You're not nearly done. Okay, after Stonewall. I mean, I think a lot of people, when they recreate their lives, which, you know, I always say, if all of the people who claim to have been Stonewall now, it's like the story of the having gone around Italy, the pieces of the cross, you know, these little fragments. And I kind of tried to mentally, years ago, put them together. And I realized they would be bigger than the Empire State Building, you know. And that's kind of what Stonewall's like. You know, all of these people have put themselves in the picture. But, you know, and there's a way in which I don't object to it. Because every group of people has to have an origin story. And our origin story is Stonewall. You know, and, you know, if in the Old Testament people are going two by two into the ark along with the giraffes and the other animals, we're coming two by two out of the Stonewall. You know, whoever we are, you know, white, black, Spanish, gay, lesbian, and trans. And it doesn't matter in some ways. It does matter historically if that's accurate, but people have this thirst to have a story back then that really includes them. You know, so after Stonewall happened, I wanted to join this movement that might include me. And what's important to me is not the Stonewall Uprising. I didn't know what would happen. I thought, personally, I thought that maybe the people who were in the Stonewall would go to Fire Island on July 4th, and that would be the end of it. I think people who think they had a crystal ball are repolishing that ball. I just really didn't know. It was the Gay Liberation Front that came along and said, look, we're going to try and change everything. That's what made the difference for me, that we were going to create our own culture, that we tried to create dances, and we tried to tackle the media and make them use dirty words like gay, which could not be printed in newspapers in 1969, and that we took on all of these things. And like you, I really felt this invisibility. And there was some degree to which that was also true within the Gay Liberation Front. There were some men in there who really could not hear women's voices, just as there were women in the women's movement who couldn't hear lesbian voices, or there were women like Betty Friedan who, if she heard a lesbian voice, would get rid of the lesbian. That was her solution. Call us the Lavender Menace and out you went. Although I guess maybe we should thank her in retrospect for that lovely term. Although she, let me tell you, she was not grateful that she got stuck with that. I mean, in the 1990s, I got into an elevator with Betty, and she pointed a finger at me. She said, you caused me so much trouble, she said to me. I couldn't believe it. I thought, you know, first I thought, Betty's memory is better than people give her credit for. And then I said, Betty, no, Betty, you caused yourself so much trouble, Betty, right? If you hadn't been such a bigot. But, you know, this is true. Women had to find a place. And even today, when I see much of the coverage of Stonewall 50 years later, and one of the reasons I'm so pleased to be on this panel is that we represent two of the groups who are really written out of this narrative. You know, I mean, the only black gay man I have seen on any program is Jonathan Capehart. And, you know, occasionally there's a white lesbian. You don't see, you know, you hardly see a lesbian of color, and you never see a female-to-male transsexual. So that Stonewall 50, interestingly, as we go forward, we again see this kind of erasure of lesbian voices, of black gay male voices, of female to male transsexual voices, and the only people who are left are the white gay men and transsexual women of color, sometimes living, and sometimes the voices of Sylvia and Marcia speak to us from the grave, you know, because they're not here to speak for themselves. And so at this juncture, I find this a little bit troubling as we go forward, that we are here. I'm so pleased to be on a panel where this is not true. It's not that I object to white gay men speaking. That's not the issue. I object when, you know, because, you know, Mark knows I love him, and Jason and I have bonded over unruly audience members that we have bonded against, but we won't mention names. And it really, it's to this picture that the Stonewall we want it to be, but then when they recreate the picture, it's a partial picture. And I think that we lesbians from the very beginning in the Gay Liberation Front, one of the things we had to do was struggle to find our voice and our space. And eventually we separated to some degree, forming a group called Radical Lesbians, and which we struggled even to find a name because, you know, if you put six lesbians in a room, we have 20 opinions. And we called ourselves Radical Radishes, and we didn't know what to call ourselves because we were kind of red on the outside, white in the middle. And eventually it was Radical Lesbians. And people think we were the Lavender Menace. And this is part of it, too. People don't even know what our name was. You know, talk about call me by my name. So going forward here, you know, we need at this juncture, you know, what is it that we've moved forward after Stonewall 2, we need to have a more complete picture of who was there after Stonewall. And you're doing a good job of doing that. I totally agree with you that we have to embrace young people. One of the things that we don't want is to ghettoize young people or to be ghettoized, you know, as older people. And it's really important to have more dialogues across generations.
Yeah, I think we're running close to time. So we'll take some questions from the audience.
My question is to Mr. Hall. How connected did you ever feel to the Harlem Renaissance?
How connected did I feel to the Harlem Renaissance?
Because, I mean, obviously there were so many gay people and who were probably recognized as gay way back then.
Yes, there were. There were a lot of gay people that were involved in the Harlem Renaissance. One of the people that we gave a tribute to just last, 2 years ago in Chicago was Duke Ellington's protege, Billy Strayhorn. Billy Strayhorn was openly gay. So was Bessie Smith. So was actually Miles Davis. And several other people that you might not know about. However, everything was in the closet. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you couldn't say that you were gay. Now, there were people that did stand up and say that they were gay. Barrett Ruskin being one of them, Billy Strayhorn being another one, but they suffered as a result of that. They were thrown out of the movement. Billy Strayhorn was actually actually thrown out of music practically. And the only reason that we know about him is that his granddaughter is a friend of mine and actually informed me that the music that we hear, even as the A-Train music, was not really written by Duke Ellington at all. You see, he was a shield for the protection of Billy Strayhorn, so that Billy could be gay, but he was the front man. So nothing against him, you know, because Duke Ellington did great music, but Billy Strayhorn did most of it. But he never gets credit for that. So a lot of times, a lot of gay people are always in the background. We're always hidden. But yes, I feel a very strong connection to the Harlem Renaissance. And I think that we're living it still now. It's still here.
Thank you very much for being here and talking about these things. I think it's so important that the history is made known and continues. One question I have, we're talking about the diversity and everything, and one thing that was left out of the discussion was the age. I was older at Stonewall. I was 27, and I had lived an even more repressive era than some of the young folks there. In my day, we trembled. We had such fear. Mm-hmm. I never told a straight person that I was gay, ever, ever, ever. Wouldn't think of it. You would lose everything. You could be killed. It was that serious. Mm-hmm. We memorized, when I finally met a couple of other gay people, we memorized each other's phone numbers. No way you'd write them down in case the police raided the place or something like that. So it's another element. I wonder if much is being written about that. Are there resources for that era?
Well, I think you're just beginning to see an awakening in our community about LGBT senior issues. I mean, we really have to become in touch with that. We haven't. Let me give you an example. Carla has done well for herself in her life, and I've done okay in mine. But our generation is, the three of us, our generation basically is the first out generation. And many of the people of our age and of, you know, and above, if you were out in those days, as you said, you were in the closet. Most people were, 99.9%. Most people who were at Stonewall that night ran for the subway when they got outside. Only the people who had no prospects in life were the ones who stayed. I mean, that's why it was people of color, trans people, and street kids like me who stayed. I was living at the YMCA, and I just learned this week, and Carla was in on the email chain this week, I just learned that I was considered homeless at that time. I was living at the YMCA. I didn't think that was homeless. But we're the first out generation, and because we were, we suffered a great deal. Many of our people couldn't get decent jobs where they have 401ks. Many of the people of our age, our generation, were basically abandoned by your family. And we all know those are the two most important things you could do when you're a senior. And what are we doing for LGBT seniors, that first out generation? We've just started to look at their issues. And in this city and four others around the country, we've opened up LGBT senior affordable buildings. And we have three people here who live in one on the front row. We just opened one in New York, which we're very proud of, Stonewall Housing. There's one in Chicago at Houston Center, another in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco. And that's it at the moment, ladies and gentlemen. We're still trying to build them. And that's really important because a lot of the older generation doesn't have that. And the other thing we need to do is become intergenerational. We need to have dialogues between young gay people and LGBT seniors. I'm 68 years old. I'm just old. But and I like being old, and I love the idea of mentoring people. It's one of my favorite things in the entire world. And I literally, most of you have never heard me say this, but I literally call people I mentor my children.
I do, too.
Yeah. And we take great pride when that happens. But this is an issue. We've only begun to create LGBT community since 1969. There really wasn't before. There was only four places gay people went. Those organizations, private parties, illegal clubs, and cruising areas. Up until Stonewall and GLF, which are synonymous, that was it. We began in GLF to create a community. As Carlos said, we had dances. We publicized dances. I mean, it was illegal to do that, and we publicized it, and that's why we, by the way, that's why we demonstrated against the Village Voice, because they wouldn't accept our ad. Yeah. We wanted to put that in the Village Voice, and they wouldn't let us. Anyway, so I hope I answered your question in a roundabout way.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. So what do you think the movement should do in response to corporate pride campaigns? And what are corporate pride campaigns doing to the movement? Should we embrace the visibility or resist the commodification?
There's three of us, and we're going to have nine opinions.
Carla?
I think that the marches are for the people. And it really troubles me and pains me that, for example, the Heritage of Pride March, which is coming up, you know, at the end of the month in New York, is now projected to be 12 hours long. And the community organizations and the nonprofits which built this march up are going to be at the back of that, while the corporations are going to be at the front. Because television, and it is broadcast now, only covers the first 3 hours. To me, I think this is really appalling. We need to find other ways. I realize that it's very expensive to put on this queer version of the Macy's Day Parade. I do realize that. But, you know, they could hang, for example, banners along the route rather than having them take up the first 3 hours with their floats. And one of the things I know, because, you know, you may have noticed that I came out here with a sight cane. So I fight on two levels. I'm also quite visually disabled. And I am a client of several organizations as a person who's legally blind. And I know that a lot of these people who work for these corporations, that they are getting comp time, compensation time, for doing these things. And, you know, for example, they do things like, you know, I don't like to do them anymore, but they'll take blind people to Central Park and row us around the pond there, which is, you know, and, you know, you don't know me, but I say, you get in the back, I'm rowing. You know, you don't tell this lesbian who's rowing, you know, it's like, but never mind. You know, Deloitte and Touche ain't telling me who's rowing. But never mind. But still, those people who are in their contingents aren't exactly paid, but they're paid in two ways. And a lot of people don't know this. And I think there's an article recently that exposed this. They're paid with comp time off, and they're often, if they do a certain number of hours, their favorite charity is given $500 by the corporation. And so they're paid in two different ways. And that time that they put in also counts towards their promotions. So, you know, there is this culture. On one hand, it's better that corporations have people who want to help the community. And a lot of the people I know, they really love the rowing in Central Park and the pizza. And I have to say, you know, there's a good side to this, because otherwise they wouldn't get to Central Park. But when they start to take over our marches, this is going too far. It really is. And we have to start finding another way to march without them. And I think, on the other hand, it's not right on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising for there to be a split. I find this extraordinarily painful that there are two marches. And that there's a Reclaim Pride March in New York, and there's the Heritage of Pride. But I agree with Reclaim that the corporations are wielding too much power within the mainstream march.
Hi, my name's Rebecca. I've had a really great privilege. I'm an attorney, and I've had a really great privilege of establishing common law marriages for same-sex couples who have been together. And so three of those couples, of probably 10 I've done, have been together for more than 50 years. And so I guess my question is, sort of, there seems to be, for a certain generation who predate Stonewall or were adults at the time of Stonewall, less, you know, I'm doing these cases because at the end of, you know, life, someone's died and they're hit with a 15% inheritance tax bill, and then we're establishing that they were in fact in a common law marriage. I wonder how much, and so it seems that people were together for so many decades that the importance of marriage became lesser. However, sort of the, you know, so much of the more recent movement was focused on marriage, and I'm sort of wanting to know sort of about the disconnect between, you know, the more recent focus on marriage, and then, you know, people, you know, Stonewall, you know, who are there at Stonewall, who still are sort of, you know, not connected in that way, but that I feel like the importance changed, and for a lot of people of that generation, there doesn't seem to be importance of marriage or that they've been together for so long, but really in the more recent movement, that was so much of a focus.
Well, I think we're often, I like to believe we have the issue du jour in the gay community. This year it's gays in the military, then it's marriage, and it goes back and forth. Unfortunately, with that issue du jour, we didn't really pick up the most important issue, which is the Equality Act. Do you know the Equality Act has sat in Congress since 1976? And if we had the Equality Act through Congress, we had many opportunities. That wedding cake that went to the Supreme Court, we would have won that. We are second-class citizens until the Equality Act goes through. You can get married today, but guess what? In many states in America, you go home and you get fired for just getting married. That's equality. As far as the issue of marriage and generational, which is what I think you're asking, my personal issue was that we didn't need that piece of paper. If we love each other, we'll just stick together. And I think I use that now as an excuse because I never thought, standing outside Stonewall at 18, I never thought that I'd have the right to get married. And so when we got the right here in Pennsylvania, which was, by the way, a year before the Supreme Court ruled, my husband, did you ask me or did I ask you? See, this is why I love him. He's the most diplomatic man I know. We got our license and we got married, and I really thought, okay, it's just a piece of paper, it could be another day. And I wrote these incredible vows, and he wrote these incredible vows. We got before the judge, Judge Dan Andrews, if any of you know him. And Jason beautifully read his vows to me, which were the happiest day of my life. And I came, put the paper up to my face, and I just cried. I could not get a word out. I didn't do my vows. And Judge Andrews said, I now pronounce you husband and husband. And that night, we were getting undressed, getting ready to go to bed, and I just looked over to him, and he was looking at me the most beautiful way that I have never seen someone else look at me since my mother had died. So it's more than just a piece of paper, at least it is to me. It was the happiest day of my life, and just looking at him now just brings a smile to my face for 15 years now. I don't know if that answers it or not, but it doesn't answer the taxation thing.
To get to her, back to her question, I mean, one of the things I'd like to say is that when we started the Gay Liberation Front, I mean, one of the things that's kind of sad about the demise of the Gay Liberation Front is that we wanted a more radical approach to life. And there were a lot of communes that were part of the Gay Liberation Front, and we wanted to find other ways to live. And we, many of us back then thought that marriage hadn't worked so well for heterosexuals, and why should we be copying this failed institution? And while, you know, I feel, you know, very honestly, you know, as a hypocrite, because I am married, and I would do it again, but I don't think that this was the way we should have gone or put our energy into that, because we as humanists and gay liberationists should have thought about all of the people involved, and we should have made sure that everybody, whether you were single or you wanted to be in a couple or you wanted to live as three people or in a commune, that everybody could find some way to all have the same rights. And you still shouldn't have to get married in this country to have health care or to stay in an apartment that is rent controlled or stabilized. And this still is something I think that we really have to take on. We have to get away from this kind of narrow focus. And I think most people here are LGBTQ. We have to get away from our focus on ourselves and think about the people in the community who want other things to be done for their stability in the world.
That's beautiful, honey. I feel very much the same. I think that the whole idea of marriage to me was an important issue. It ended up being an important issue. But I do agree with you because I think that we should not try to identify ourselves as married in a heterosexual perspective, because we're not heterosexuals. So therefore, we should create we create our own definition of marriage for us, because it's very different, I think, from a heterosexual marriage. I think that my relationship, and we've been together 21 years, Craig, that is, we were just married, 8 years ago? We went through everything.
Why does he have
because
the answers down there?
He's the librarian. Oh, okay. He's the librarian, honey. He knows everything. Okay. Those librarians know everything, honey, I'm telling you. But I think that it is important for us to identify who we are and clarify who we are for ourselves and not be determined by other people or defined by other people who are not like us and who do not really represent us or who do not have our interests, our best interests as theirs. So I'm still in a kind of very radical perspective about that. Also, the issue of, I'm going to bring it up one more time, the issue of race. It has to be dealt with in this community. If anybody can do it, we can, because straight people are not going to do it. They're not going to do it. And the only way that we can do that is to engage ourselves and get out of this mindset that there's something wrong with blackness, when blackness is actually, when you look up in the sky at night, you see the stars, but behind that, you see blackness. Okay? So to me, there's more blackness than there is light. Now, that's not a put down. I'm just saying that we all come from the same place. And once you understand that and have that understanding, that scientific DNA understanding of who we really are, we would not have these problems of racism, not in our community. So youth and racism, those are our two issues, I think, moving forward.
Seniors?
And of course, seniors. I'm a senior, too. I try to think of myself as a senior.
And transition.
In transition, yes, definitely. And I think, you know, I think there are more homeless seniors now than there are young people. If not, it's coming close. Gay seniors. So that's who we need to be looking out for. 13%, that's high.
You're going to have the last word.
I'm
going
to have the last word.
So okay. Thank you all for coming. I think we're available to talk after the show, and I can sign books, and any of them can sign books, and please read the Stonewall Reader
Jason's book. Get Jason's book. He'll be outside signing them. It is wonderful. It's the best compilation of stories from Stonewall and people who came before and after. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Jason. A great book. Pick up a copy. Thank you, Free Library, for having us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.